From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. Deconstructing Dinner is heard weekly on radio stations across the country, including CHSR Fredericton, New Brunswick, and CJJJ Brandon, Manitoba. I'm John Steinman. On today's episode, we'll listen in once again on recordings from the University of Alberta's International Week, held in early February 2009 in Edmonton. The theme of the event was Hungry for Change, Transcending Feast, Famine, and Frenzy. On last week's episode, we heard from keynote speaker Francis Moore LaPay on the topic of ending hunger and feeding hope. And it was on the following day of the event that Indian journalist Palagumi Sainath addressed a standing room only audience. His talk was titled The Age of Inequality, The Wages of Market Fundamentalism. Based in Mumbai, P. Sainath is the rural affairs editor for India's national newspaper, The Hindu. He is the author of Everybody Loves a Good Drought, Stories from India's Poorest Districts, and he was instrumental in breaking the story about farmer suicides in India, a story that has been told around the world as a harsh reminder of how our global food system impacts the poorest regions on the planet. The topic that Palagumi Sainath spoke of speaks to one of the goals of Deconstructing Dinner, and that is to discover how our food choices here in North America affect people abroad. On today's episode, we'll learn how, because of our support of the globalized industrial food system here in North America, farmers in India and abroad are committing suicide. While Palagumi Sainath recognizes this very disconnect as being fundamental to neoliberal policies, similar to Francis Moore LaPay, he too believes that we are all capable of moving beyond this system that breeds gross inequality, and instead encourage the growth of systems that are fair, just, and responsible. A reminder that today's broadcast will be archived as usual at deconstructingdinner.ca and listed under the February 12th, 2009 episode. Introducing Palagumi Sainath at the University of Alberta's International Week was Ricardo Acuna, the executive director of the Parkland Institute.
After earning a master's degree in history, Sainath embarked on a career in journalism. But by 1991, he'd come to understand that, in his words, conventional journalism was above all about the service of power. You always give the last word to authority. He decided at that point that if the mainstream media in India was going to move away from genuine news and towards covering entertainment, he would move in the opposite direction. He wrote at that time, and I quote, "I felt that if the Indian press was covering the top 5%, I should cover the bottom 5%. Since that time, Sainath has been reporting on the lives and struggles of the poor in India's rural interior. More importantly, however, he's been using his writing to show Indians and people around the world the connection between the daily struggles of India's poor and the policies of neoliberal globalism. Sainath spends a great majority of his time in the communities of the rural interior and has done so for the last 14 years. He's the author of the highly acclaimed book, Everybody Loves a Good Drought, Stories from India's Poorest Districts, and he's the current rural affairs editor for The Hindu. His writing has not only raised public awareness of the impacts of globalization and previously hidden issues like India's farmer suicides, but has also contributed to concrete policy changes in India and inform development debates globally. His unflinching coverage of the negative impacts of neoliberal policy on India's poorest populations has earned him over 30 awards, including the Amnesty International's Global Human Rights Journalism Prize and the Ramon Magsaysay Award for Journalism, Literature, and Creative Communication. His current project is on the agrarian crisis nationwide, particularly those regions where its effects are most severe. He has filed over 100 reports on the subject in recent years and has personally taken all the photographs that go with those reports, some of the ones that were flashing on the screen during the introductions. These pictures of the families of the suicide victims makes up the only photo record of its kind in existence. Please help me welcome P. Sainath.
Thank you. Thank you so much. What a wonderful turnout. My friend and colleague Joe Mullins was carrying me this evening. He was warning me that I was going to be competing with the Oilers. But thank you for coming. For two decades now, the United Nations Development Program and other organs of the United Nations have been telling us that an additional expenditure of $60 to $80 billion a year, will help the human race sort out all the basic problems, the most basic problems of hunger, health, sanitation, education, literacy, and issues like that. The estimate for sanitation, for instance, is an additional expenditure of $10 billion a year. For hunger, it's between $15 and $20 billion, according to the Secretary General. Another $10 billion on health, water, literacy. You can sort out the basic problems of the human race with an additional expenditure of $60 to $80 billion a year. Now, the UN has been putting this out for about two decades, and it has never happened because governments have told us there's no money. There's just no money. We can't do it. We can't spend that much. Where's the money going to come from? But when crisis struck the suits in Wall Street, governments figured out that they could raise $1.5 trillion in 7 days. Yeah. Not 60 to 80 billion. $1.5 trillion. In a week, they found the money. Because you see, a crisis is only a crisis when it hits the suits, not before that. And what's the solution to that crisis? To throw those trillions of dollars at the guys who got you into the mess. So that's the world we live in. Flashback about a year and a half ago. Less than a year ago. Around early to mid-2008, with global food prices reaching an all-time high, and for the first time after World War II, with the middle classes of Western societies being worried about food prices, with wheat prices going up 77% in the first 3 months in a country like India, and food prices rising all over the world, that noted nutritionist, George W., declared from the White House, that the problem really was that the Indians and Chinese are eating so much. It's very unthinking of them. You know, I mean, really. Now, of course, President Bush had considerable expertise in this area. He had personal experience of problems with eating. He once choked on a pretzel and blacked out for 2 minutes. As David Letterman pointed out, it was very fortunate that those were precisely the 2 minutes that Dick Cheney was conscious that week. However, note that all the major journals monitoring and covering these issues, the media, agreed with Bush. The Wall Street Journal wrote an editorial, which I quote for you. It agreed with him that the problem was really that these guys are eating too much. It uses the words, China and India are gobbling food. 2.25 billion turkeys, okay? Okay. They're gobbling food. As never before. And therefore, food prices are soaring, said the WSJ editorial. It reminded me of the late Murray Kempton's definition of who an editorial writer is. Murray Kempton, editing The New Republic in the 60s, once wrote, "The job of the editorial writer is to go down into the valley after the battle is over and shoot the wounded." Now, is this true, that the food price crisis was caused by Indians and Chinese eating a lot more? Well, when food prices reduced by 45% shortly after, does that mean that Indians and Chinese started starving again? Actually, 10 to 15% of the Indian population are eating better than they ever did before, the per capita availability of food grain in India has actually declined and declined very sharply in the years of the neoliberal reforms from 1991 to 2005-2006. In 1991, as India stood on the cusp of the brave new world of neoliberalism, the food grain available per Indian, that is, cereals, pulses, the whole works, was 510 grams per Indian. 15 years of market fundamentalism, 15 years of neoliberalism, and the food grain available for per Indian fell from 510 grams per Indian to 422 grams per Indian. Now, my friends, that's not a fall of 88 grams per person. It's a fall of 88 grams into 365 days into 1 billion human beings, which means that your average poor family was consuming 100 kilograms less of food grain than they did just 10 years ago. Now, if the top 10 or 20% were eating better than ever before on a shrinking cake, then it raises the question of what the heck were the bottom 40% eating? You know? I mean, I'm sure Bush would tell us, but he isn't here. At the very moment that President Bush was speaking, at that period, tribals in India, in the state of Rajasthan, practice what they practice every year. It's called rotating hunger. A family of eight, there's not enough work to be had, and everybody can't be in physically good shape. So the tribals, many of the tribes in these areas, what they do is, two members of the family eat very well that day, the others starve. So that those two are fit to go out and do physical labor on the rural employment sites. Because they have to have the nourishment to be able to do the work. So the others go hungry and those two eat and go out and do the work. The next day, another two eat and go out and do the work so that they're able to do the work. They rotate the hunger between them. Okay, and the food price crisis was caused by these people. Incidentally, food prices then fell. Now, why did this, you know, a month after President Bush made his statement, I was covering the food price crisis in India, where wheat prices went up 77% in 3 months, and at the rural employment guarantee sites of the government of India, 74 and 75-year-old people were going back to work in 47 degrees Celsius in the heat because their old age pensions were wiped out by the food price increase. It's about 200, 300 rupees a month which they get. They had to, and when a crisis like that comes in these poor households, the old, the widows get completely marginalized because they're seen as unproductive. They can't work. So we interviewed and recorded and filmed people who were 74, 75 years old reporting back for stone-breaking work in the field. And consider that 74 years old against the life expectancy of Indians, not Canadians. But there was something else happening at the same time. The food companies, the agribusiness companies, were recording all-time historic profits. Wall Street companies, index funds like the BlackRock Index Fund, all of them were heavily into betting on food. You see, at some point, the planet is going to discover that it can live without oil if it has to. Because, you know, the human race did manage that a few thousand years. But you can't live without food and water. And therefore, you had food prices growing up as index funds were, you know, investing unprecedented sums of money in purchasing land, in purchasing companies that manufactured pesticide or seed. You had also unprecedented levels of speculation in the futures markets and forward trading. The very same process that pushed up oil prices so high and then brought them down, pushed up food prices so high before bringing them down, though not bringing them down to the same level as before. Speculation. That was pretty much a Wall Street phenomenon. At the height of the food price crisis, Archer Daniels Midland recorded its all-time highest profits. And within its profits, that division of Archer Daniels Midland is the giant grain processor. Within its profits, the unit of Archer Daniels dealing with grain storage, trading, not grain production. The unit of Archer Daniels dealing with grain storage, transportation, and trading reported a sevenfold increase in income, while tens of millions of people joined the ranks of the hungry around the world. The giant seed and herbicide company, Monsanto, similarly reported windfall profits in each of those quarters. Mosaic, the fertilizer company, reported similar huge profits. What we were seeing and what we are seeing even now is the biggest vertical and horizontal integration of corporations cornering the world by its belly. The integration of food from the control of land, from the control of water through the privatization of rural irrigation in dozens of countries, through the control of seed, pesticide manufacture, other agricultural inputs, all being tied up by a handful of corporations.
This is Deconstructing Dinner. You're listening to journalist Palagumi Sainath speaking in February 2009 in Edmonton at the University of Alberta. Based in Mumbai, Palagumi is the rural affairs editor for India's national newspaper, The Hindu. Today's entire broadcast is featuring segments from his talk, and I will note that some segments that could not fit into today's one-hour broadcast will be made available on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca. As Palagumi continued his talk, titled The Age of Inequality, he addressed the current unraveling of the global economy, and he suggested that what we see happening today is only the beginning of a much greater unraveling of an entire system built upon artificiality. Here again is Palagumi Sainath.
So you're seeing that kind of a vertical integration, and it's growing. From the purchase of farmland, which is what the BlackRock and other index funds were investing in, the number of companies is getting smaller and smaller in this extremely unequal process. At the one end of this process are hundreds of millions plus millions of newly hungry. At the other end of the spectrum are record profits made from hunger. Inequality was the driving force, not just behind these activities, but behind what everybody now refers to as the meltdown, the Wall Street meltdown, which I'm intrigued to find being discussed by, you know, by television anchors, and as if it's something that has happened and we're fixing it. I believe the meltdown has just begun. Okay, we are in phase one. Every great depression, every economic catastrophe, every major economic collapse in history has been preceded by years of absolutely unsustainable levels of inequality. America in 1929, at the time of the Great Depression, was more unequal than America had ever been. America in 2008 was more unequal than America had ever been since 1929. Okay, every such catastrophe has been preceded by absolutely unsustainable levels of inequality. And if you think that the crisis is over, just look at from September 1, if you look at the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics website, it's easily available to you. From September 1 to December 31, the U.S. has been losing 16,000 jobs every day. In September, that was 3,000 jobs a day. By the end of December, it was 16,000 jobs a day. In November and December alone, the U.S. economy lost 1.1 million jobs, 584,000 jobs in November, 524,000 jobs in December, and the December figure is a provisional one. When the final figure comes in, it's going to be around 600,000. Okay. Now, you're laying off 500,000 people each month in the last 2-3 months. A week and a half ago, 50,000 people lost their jobs in a single day. But look at how Wall Street and the banks and the suits continue to function. In the midst of all this chaos, as we throw hundreds of millions and hundreds of billions of dollars at the same guys who cause the problems, Citibank decides to buy a $50 million corporate jet and has to be stopped by the Treasury Secretary personally from doing so. Meanwhile, the head of Merrill Lynch redecorates his office at a cost of $1.22 million on taxpayer bailout money And part of the redecoration is an antique commode on legs costing $35,000. Maybe that was heavy symbolism, considering that his company was right down the tube. But this is not, this crisis is not about a housing mortgage bubble. It isn't. That's a mistake. It's a very narrow understanding of what has happened. Okay? The credit card bubble is yet to strike. Okay, and that'll take, when you're laying off 500,000 people each month, you're going to have millions of people in 6 to 7 months who will default on their credit cards. And toxic debt in credit card is 3 times as high as in housing mortgages. It's 30 to 35% as against 10 to 12%. So when the credit, and then that's just one more bubble, the credit card. Then you've got the private equity bubble. Then you've got the realty bubble. You've got more bubbles than in bath foam in that economy. Okay? And you're having giant layoffs going on at the same time. Consider how we got here. In the year 2008, when 2.75 million Americans lost their jobs, which is the highest number of layoffs since the year 1945, when all the war-related enterprises closed down in the United States, in a year when 2.75 million people were laid off, CEOs and chief executives and other top executives paid themselves bonuses of $18 billion. Okay. And after getting public bailout money, have continued to do that until they get, if they can do it without getting caught. So you had CEO salaries exploding at one end of the spectrum and working folks, everyday Joes, and their salaries stagnating or shrinking at the other end. It couldn't last. You know, you'd have to be an economist to believe that it could. Anyone else knows that it can't. Now here's the thing. In the worst year of layoffs, with 2.75 million people losing their jobs, 18 states in the United States have cut their welfare rolls. They've reduced their welfare lists. Direct cash assistance in the welfare system is at its lowest in 40 years. But CEO salaries were at their highest in all-time history. Okay? You cannot sustain that kind of inequality. It's just not possible. They've tried and you've failed. Here's another interesting thing. Most of these corporations didn't pay a dime in corporate income tax. The Government Accountability Office of the United States has done a study which came out in October last year, which shows that between 1998 and 2005, two-thirds of corporations in the United States paid zero corporate income tax. At a time when corporate profits were at their highest in history, because in 2006, corporate profits as a share of the nation's total income stood at 14.1%, which was the highest in history, but their tax payments were the lowest since the 1930s. You cannot sustain a system like that. It's not possible. Remember that John McCain complained during the election campaign. He was still on the reduced taxes line, and he was saying that American corporations are being levied the highest rates of taxes in the world, but they have the lowest rates of payments. Okay. The rate may be the highest. It couldn't last. It was a fake world with fake products. And as the economist Nouriel Roubini of NYU says, all the bubbles are blowing and bursting at the same time now. We are in big trouble. It doesn't matter which part of the world you're in. Yeah. We've been co-opted into that bubble. In the last 15 to 20 years, inequality has grown at a faster rate than at any time in the preceding 50 years. In India, for instance, it is today at a level that can only be compared to the colonial period of British rule. And we managed that level of inequality in the space of 15 years. Imagine the decompression it has meant in the incomes, livelihoods, and diets of poor people. It's a make-believe world where mythical managers sell mythical products, financial products, so complex that Warren Buffett says he hasn't a clue what they're about. Yeah. Complex products. I mean, a lot of people bankrupted by Madoff don't know it yet, because the system never actually invested in anything that produced anything. You know, I give X securities my money to invest. He gets 1% as the fund manager, and he gets from 15 to 20% of the benefits. Then he passes it on to another fund manager who passes it on to another fund manager, and it's been making the circles in Wall Street without actually being invested in anything that produces anything except more bubbles. But why do I insist that the inequality of the last 15, 20 years is dramatically different from inequality in other periods? There is a big difference. There have been periods of gross inequality in the past. But never in history has inequality been so cynically constructed, so ruthlessly engineered, and so brutally imposed on hundreds of millions of people across the planet. That's structural inequality. India, for example, let's take India. We are the shining, I mean, India shining is the slogan, right? We are the star pupil of the star graduate of the neoliberal school. India today has 51 billionaires. By the way, that's more than twice the number of billionaires Canada has, okay? You have 25. Our dads are richer than your dads. Yeah. Now, India has 51 billionaires to your piffling 25. But you know something else? In the Human Development Index of the United Nations, Canada ranks number 4, and India, which ranks number 4 in billionaires, ranks 128 in human development, below Bolivia, the poorest country of Latin America, and below several African countries too. Okay, how did we manage that? Now, if you want to know how concentrated the wealth is, how great the inequality is, India has a population of just over 1 billion. But the 51 billionaires hold assets and wealth equivalent to 31% of our GDP. Okay, equivalent to 31% of our GDP. Incidentally, the number one country in the world in the Human Development Index went down the tube itself because of embracing the fake economy, and that was Iceland. Okay, it was number one. It embraced this fake financial economy, you know, separate from financial products and banking services, and look at poor Iceland now. And we're talking about these, when we're talking about these billionaires, or 23 of them have an address in the same city as I do. It's Mumbai. We're not talking about slumdog millionaires. We're talking about penthouse billionaires. Okay? We're talking about Mr. Mukesh Ambani of Reliance Limited, who is building the costliest residence in the world, residential complex in the world, his personal house, in the costliest real estate in the world. Well, so far the home has a mere 60 floors. And being a modest man, there are only 3 helipads so far in it. Yeah. See, this kind of inequality that you've created, this kind of inequality we've generated, it has an impact on the mindset. It has an impact on the way we see other human beings. It has an impact on, you know, you cannot. Even if you go back to the periods of, say, slavery, you had to absolutely dehumanize the slave in order to live with yourself. By indulging in slavery, you had to accept you had to create the idea that the slave was not a human being, and therefore you could brutalize him endlessly because he was not a human being; he was an animal. And that's the kind of mindset, that's the kind of logic that inequality, gross inequality, generates. You know, I cannot be earning 100,000 times more than you and treat you as my equal. There's no way that's going to happen. The great American jurist Justice Brandeis, when dismissing, what was he dismissing? He was dismissing a case seeking the abolition of income tax. And Justice Brandeis summed it all up so beautifully in one line. He said, you can have great concentration of wealth, or you can have democracy, but you can't have both.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. You've been listening to Indian journalist Palagumi Sainath speaking in February 2009 in Edmonton, Alberta. Palagumi is the author of Everybody Loves a Good Drought, Stories from India's Poorest Districts. He has received over 30 awards, including Amnesty International's Global Human Rights Journalism Prize and the Raymond Magsaysay Award for Journalism, Literature, and Creative Communication. Again, segments of Palagumi's talk that do not make their way onto today's broadcast will be made available on the Deconstructing Dinner website under the February 12, 2009 broadcast. In this next segment, which will take us to the end of his talk, Palagumi speaks of the dangers found when a country switches from producing food crops to cash crops, and the results help those of us here in North America who support the globalized industrial food system recognize how our food choices here impact rural populations abroad.
I was mentioning that we are 128th in human development, which places us in the bottom 50 nations of the world in human development. But when it comes to child malnutrition, we are not 128th. We are 177, bottom. If you take percentage, these are UN figures, UNDP's figures, HDI figures. If you take children below the age of 5 who are underweight, Guinea-Bissau, 25% of children. Sierra Leone, Burkina Faso, 36% of children. Sierra Leone, 38% of children. Ethiopia, 38% of all children below 5 are underweight. India, 47%. With 51 billionaires. I'm trying to tell you this, I'm trying to say this, don't try understanding the wealth in isolation from the poverty. The two are inextricably linked. You cannot understand the deprivation if you do not understand the wealth. You cannot understand the wealth if you do not look at the deprivation. These are not isolated compartments. One makes the other possible. Oh, in the Global Hunger Index, the IFPRI, many of you have heard of the International Food Policy Research Institute of Washington, D.C., it comes out with a Global Hunger Index. India ranks 66th out of 88. This time we beat Zimbabwe by a short head, not because of our efforts, but Zimbabwe's. Last year they were ahead of us. They were one notch ahead of us last year. They're one notch below us this year. In employment, it's collapsed. In whichever sector you look at it, the number of Tatas who are the owners of Jaguar and Land Rover and, you know, Corus and the biggest steel makers have increased their steel output 4 times and reduced their workforce by half. The same with the biggest manufacturer of two-wheelers in the world, Bajaj, you know, who've increased their output 4 times, reduced their workforce by half. What has the impact of all this been on rural India, on rural communities, on farming? And I assert that farming is in crisis across the planet. If you're looking at farming by human beings, not by corporations. If you're looking at family farms, if you are not in crisis, you will be. Take my word for it. All the evidence points to it. Okay. The policies entrenching inequality have been pushed by powerful corporations and nations, institutionalized by bodies like the World Bank and the IMF, and embraced by elite states, by elites in countries like India, Pakistan, and elsewhere. Willfully embraced, I mean joyously embraced. As corporate power grows, the impact of inequality on the countryside, on agriculture, has been devastating. Because remember, that is the last frontier. When you capture food and water, you've got just about everything. From 1991, from the period of the economic reforms, 8 million people have quit farming in India. If you look at the 91 census, there were 111 million cultivators. 2001 census, there's 103 million cultivators. Where did these 8 million people go? We don't know, because the media were busy covering Paris Hilton, right? So we really do not know where 8 million, and when you see the 2011 census, you're going to see that figure dwarfed by the number of people who have left after 2000. Investment in agriculture collapsed using the WTO, using a number of levers, in the names of fighting subsidy, while Western subsidies grew and grew and grew. Subsidies as a share of farming income in USA were 2% in 1974 and 47% in 2000 as a share of income, a farming income. And I'm not talking about American family farms, I'm talking about corporate farms, because American family farms are down the dumps like anyone else. Don't think that the West is exempted. Today in the United States, there are 3 times the number of people in prison as there are in family farms. There are 700,000 family farms going bankrupt at the rate of 160 a week, while there are 2.3 million people in state and federal and state penitentiaries. So you have investment in agriculture collapsing. Each year, we reduced investment in agriculture to the rate of about $7 to $8 billion a year, and we directed that money towards the upper middle class consumption of urban India. I have covered the suicides of farmers in India. Farmers who have committed suicide because they could not get a crop loan of $200 except at exorbitant rates of interest. And having covered that suicide, I've gone home to my urban middle class existence and received a letter from my bank welcoming me to buy a Mercedes-Benz at 4% interest without collateral. And that guy could not get $200 for his crop loan except at 14 to 18%. Because we were transferring resources from poor to rich. We took bank credit away from poor people because that's the whole idea. Consumption-led growth. What did George W. tell the population of the United States after 9/11? Go out there and spend. Okay? Even now what you're trying to say is give the banks money, they'll loan money, then you spend. Right? It's getting back into the same. The whole thing was created by a crisis of excessive credit and debt. Now this, in the period, as we took money away from the countryside, the indebtedness of the peasantry doubled. 26% of all Indian households before the neoliberal reforms began, 26% of Indian farm households were in debt. By 2001, that was 48.6%. Then all the other processes, predatory commercialization, everything converted into exchange value. Privatization on health, privatization in education, commercialization of education services, everything became so expensive. And what happened to farmers' incomes in this period? The average monthly per capita expenditure of the Indian farm household surveyed for 2002 was $10 a month. Average per capita monthly, the monthly per capita expenditure of the Indian farm household, according to the National Sample Survey, was $10. And what was the main expenditure on? 60% of that expenditure was on food. Farm households spending on food. Another 18 to 20% was on the purchase of fuel, footwear, and clothing. That left precious little for health and education. At the same time, but we did create 51 dollar billionaires. Skyrocketing of input costs as corporations took over seed control of seed, as Monsanto took over seed, as Cargill took over whole sectors of the wheat trade. The skyrocketing of input costs devastated farmers who were cultivating cotton and other stuff. It cost $50 to cultivate an acre of cotton in 1991. It now costs $375 to $400 to use Monsanto seed and cultivate an acre of cotton. And part of the neoliberal philosophy was to move millions of peasants all across the world from cultivating food, which they needed, to cultivating cash crops, which you needed. Because we had to grow stuff that won't grow in your climates. It's very difficult to grow, you know, coffee in Alaska. So people shifted, and when you shift, what happens when you shift from food crop to cash crop? When you shift from, say, growing paddy or rice to growing vanilla, what do? You undertake gigantic additional expenditures. The cultivation cost of paddy is less than $180 an acre. The cultivation cost of vanilla $3,000 per acre, 150,000 rupees per acre. Now that means more debt, more credit, more going to the money lender because the banks are not giving it to you. These things are happening. So the indebtedness of the peasantry goes up. The banks abandon the farmers and move away. Farm incomes collapse. Worldwide, there's a collapse of smallholder agriculture. And India's farmers are the last large body of owning smallholders in the world. And their existence is under threat. What then comes out of all this? What you saw in the photographs. Between 1997 and 2007, 182,000 farmers committed suicide, according to the government of India. That's a gross underestimate that excludes lots of groups. It excludes women farmers because women are not considered farmers. They're farmers' wives. 67% of all agricultural work is done by women. But they're not considered farmers because the property, the land is not in their name. It's in the husband's name by custom and tradition. So when a woman commits suicide, she commits suicide. That's not a farmer's suicide. It's just a suicide. But with all the exclusions, you still come up with a figure of 182,936 farm suicides in 11 years, which means the current rate of suicide is on average one farmer commits suicide every 30 minutes. That is the government figure. You are welcome. Your guess about what the real figure is as good or as bad as mine. Who are these farmers who have committed suicide? Overwhelmingly, they are cash crop farmers. Far fewer food crop farmers have committed suicide than cash crop farmers. Far fewer. Because at the end of the day, in a crisis, you can eat your paddy. Cotton is a bit harder to digest. Okay? We destroyed the livelihoods and food security of these people by pulling them out of food crop growth to cash crop growth. Don't think that farmers' suicides are a phenomenon of India only. That is not true. Oklahoma has 2.5 times, rural Oklahoma has 2.5 times the U.S. national average of farms of suicides, most of them amongst farmers. Minnesota has, unusually, through the 80s, it had an extremely high rate of farmer suicides. It's an attack on, what's it about? It's about smallholder farmers, family farms getting wiped out by the growing spread and clout of corporate farming. That's what it's about. Okay, and it goes on and it keeps up. And in the first 6 years that we worked on this, on the farm suicides, there was denial from the government. Then when we pinned it down in their own numbers, all the numbers are from the National Crime Records Bureau. In India, the Crime Records Bureau keeps suicide figures because suicide is a crime. You commit it and we'll teach you never to do it again. And when it became impossible to deny the numbers because it were their own numbers, their own police stations which had provided the figures, then they started changing the challenging the interpretation. One of the favorite interpretations is alcoholism. You know what these farmers are, you know, bunch of drunks. They're all drunkards, that's why they committed suicide. I've been asked this in meeting after meeting and meeting after meeting. But it strikes me as very interesting, this argument. If drunkenness, if excessive consumption of alcohol drives suicides, damn it, there'd be no journalists left in the world. But the role, the sad thing, and I'm going to conclude with that, the sad thing is how we have distanced ourselves from ordinary people, disconnected ourselves from the lives of others. How has all this mattered to you? How does this matter to us? We are not in the classes that are struggling. We are not in the classes that are about to collapse, though we don't know. I mean, give Wall Street time. You know, they might achieve that too. But why should we be bothered? Why should we be bothered? One, I think it speaks to the very basic humanity in us that we should be bothered. Even if you want to look at it in extremely selfish terms, you better be bothered. A hell of a lot of it is happening or coming soon to a theater near you. The farm crisis is not restricted to India. The crisis of corporate power is not restricted to India by any means. In fact, suffusion of corporate power in a society is far greater in the United States than it is in India. You can still chase corporations out in India. You can't do that in the United States. You've really got to worry about that. I believe that you have never been better positioned and better situated to turn things around because the great unraveling has begun. The great unraveling has begun. It's astonishing to watch the professionals and experts look such complete clowns, okay, as they do when they're trying to fix the economy. Also challenge, we not only challenge ourselves, we also challenge the media that give us this information. We need to do that too. Let me put it another way to you. The crisis which you associate with Wall Street and 2008, that crisis has existed in 100 societies for more than 15 years. It's only when it reaches the suits that it becomes a crisis for the rest of the world. But it's been a crisis in, you've had those farmers committing suicide for 11 years. It never became a crisis. It's a hell of a crisis for millions of families. But it never became a crisis for anyone else. It's only when, you know, Merrill Lynch tanks and Bear Stearns bails out that it becomes a crisis. So be very clear that the crisis doesn't exempt you. It doesn't exempt Alberta. The farming crisis certainly will not exempt this province. Understand that. Input costs, Monsanto, seed costs, pesticide costs. Most of the farmers who committed suicide were not only cash crop farmers, they were farmers locked into the model of heavy chemical farming, heavy chemical use, heavy use of pesticides, heavy use of high cost inputs. They were farmers locked into that model. They were very poor farmers, but they were locked into that model, and therefore they couldn't afford it, it broke them. What did the media do meanwhile in this period? We sold products where we should have told stories. We got the best bites but told the worst stories. Where skepticism was crucial, we displayed sycophancy. When we needed journalism at its best, we produced stenography at its worst. You know, I believe the unraveling has begun, but I will also say that there's apart from the critique of the economy, apart from the critique of neoliberalism, there's also the complicity of the middle classes, of all of us, in things that go on, and the choices we make and the decisions we make. It's very, very, very easy, until it becomes impossible, to disconnect from the sufferings of millions of people. It's, Indian history is replete with such examples. In 1876, for example, Victoria got bored of being a queen, and she had recently acquired a very large piece of real estate. Some of us now call it India. And she decided to call herself Empress, with due modesty. And they held a party, the biggest dinner party in the history of the human race, with 68,000 guests and 2,000 cooks. In a year when famine raged across India and millions of people died, the party lasted a week. Now, if you read the newspapers of the time, you see the same disconnect. The party is covered. They cover the party. And yes, the famine is covered. But there's no connection. The reports tell us that starving peasants trying to enter the city faced barricades from the police who clubbed them to death at the barricades. 100,000 people died of the famine in just Madras and Mysore alone during the 7 days of Victoria's Darbar. It remains one of the best secrets in history. I think only Mike Davis has written about it in late Victorian Holocaust. But it remains one of, otherwise it's a secret in history. Call it Victoria's original secret. But it shows you that an elite could so disconnect themselves from the misery enveloping the world around them. A last note for you. Some 30 years ago when I entered university, only to be expelled almost immediately, but then I re-entered again. I trained to be a historian, not a journalist. And I read the Roman historian Tacitus on Nero. And one question on that remained with me till 5-6 years ago. You know, you have Tacitus on Nero and the burning of Rome. Tacitus despised Nero, but Tacitus was somewhat objective on the history of the fire. He said that Nero did not cause the fire. In fact, Nero was very scared of how the fire was damaging his reputation amongst the masses because they believed he was responsible for it. And he had to distract the Roman public. So he held the greatest dinner party of the ancient world, right? And you can read about it. You can read about it in Tacitus. It's online. The University of, I think, Michigan has put him online. Now, they had this big problem. They had the creme de la creme of the old world, of the Roman Empire, the greatest scientists, the greatest philosophers, the greatest political figures, the centurions, the generals, the musicians, the cream. And then they had a problem in the party. It was a night party, and you needed lighting for it. A problem they solved, according to Tacitus and by other contemporary historians, by bringing out criminal prisoners from the cells and burning them at stake in the surrounding areas. In the prose of Tacitus, thereby providing the nightly illumination. Now for me, this was never the issue. The cruelty of Nero was never the issue. I mean, Nero is, we all know that Nero was nuts. Unlike all those sane, just Roman emperors who routinely fed thousands of human beings to animals each year. Right? The issue was not Nero or his cruelty. There have been much more cruel people than Nero. The issue was, who were Nero's guests? Here you had the world's great philosophers, scientists, political people, and thinkers. Not one raised a protest at the burning of human beings to provide the nightly illumination. It always intrigued me. Who were Nero's guests? What did it take to remain silent and quaff another goblet of wine as another human being went up in flames, or pop another fig into your mouth as another person burned as a human torch? After 7 years of covering farm suicides, watching one after the other farm household go belly up, I think I have my answer about who Nero's guests were. in the great unraveling that is on us, we may take different paths. We may have different answers. We may have different arguments and different solutions. But believe me, that unraveling is happening. And we can agree on one thing, that whatever we do or don't do, agree with or don't agree with, we will not be Nero's guests. Thank you.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner. You've been listening to journalist Palagumi Sainath speaking on February 3rd, 2009 in Edmonton, Alberta. Palagumi is the rural affairs editor of India's national newspaper, The Hindu. He was invited to be a featured speaker at this year's International Week, hosted annually by the University of Alberta. Deconstructing Dinner attended the event, where I spoke on three occasions and compiled a number of recordings, such as this one, to share with you. If you missed last week's keynote speaker, Francis Moore LePay, that episode is posted under the February 5th, 2009 broadcast on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. Now, to bring us to the end of today's episode, I do want to share two more segments with you from Palagumi's talk, both of these recorded during the evening's Q&A. In this first segment, Palagumi addresses a question on the promise of producing cash crops versus food crops, and he uses the example of vanilla, an ingredient found within many North American foods, but which carries an important story that most of us are completely unaware of.
The cash crop idea was actually an idea of the World Bank and the IMF. And the reasoning was this, that you see, food crop doesn't earn you anything, right? And food is cheap. Well, it's cheap in the United States, where, say, basmati rice for 30 years is cheaper to buy and consume in the United States than it is in India, where it's grown. Right? The idea was food crop growing doesn't get you anything, doesn't get you anywhere. You grow cash crop. You export. Export-led growth was the theory. And when you export to the West, you earn dollars. And then you can buy all the food you want, because we'll export food to you. So we'll give you food, and you'll have dollars, so you'll be able to buy our food. So let us do the trivial things like food production, and you do the important things like growing vanilla. Now, the second part of it is, many of these cash crops have no internal market in India or in the countries where they're grown. Vanilla, most of the vanilla produced in the world is consumed in the United States. Vanilla nation. Okay. India has a zero market for vanilla, right? And thousands of farmers shift to vanilla. And how that it also links up to a bit to your question, sir. The government pushes this idea, as I said in the processes, that local elites fully, joyously embraced the neoliberal model. It's not as if that the Indian Prime Minister accepted these policies kicking and screaming. If he was screaming, it was only with joy. So you had thousands of farmers switching to vanilla because government policies ensured, for instance, that credit went to cash crop farmers. So they coerced you, forced you, coaxed you, persuaded you, browbeat you into moving towards that. And then you were also seeing that those going cash crops were getting a much better deal in everything, at least for a while. I remember the vanilla boom in the southern Indian state of Kerala. Okay. Vayanad, the name of the district, Vayanad, is actually Vayal Nadu, which means land of paddy. It's very hard to find anyone growing paddy now. It was one of the centers of ancient centers of paddy growing. People shift to vanilla from $180 an acre for cultivation cost to $3,000. The first year, first season, this is how corporations work. The first two seasons, they made phenomenal profits. Okay. The U.S. Vanilla Association overstates the demand. All these sort of things happen. And everybody and his grandmom from Kerala to Kenya switch to vanilla. The entry of millions of farmers into vanilla immediately crashes the price at one level. Then the associations in the West restate the demand and say, oops, you know, we got a couple of zeros there by accident. In the first year, farmers made 4,500 rupees per kilogram. That's, well, this is Canada, yeah, kilogram, okay. Per kilogram of vanilla, they got a price of 4,500 rupees. That's $100 per kilogram. So they were thrilled. And everybody thought this was, you know, they were made. When I last was in Kerala, vanilla was selling for 68 rupees a kilogram, $1.30. That, my friend, is not a fluctuation, it's an annihilation. And it was a very planned annihilation. You got the mugs to get into your scheme, got them there. They had, now when they've made the investment, as many of the farmers told me, the only thing we can do with that, the only use that creeper now has, is to hang ourselves with it. Okay? So the cash crop thing was nurtured, nourished. It was part of the export-led growth idea. It was very systematically foisted on millions of people, some of whom took it willingly, believing that this was a way out of poverty, and many others who found that unless they did it, they would not get a lot of government support.
Palagumi Sainath. And in this last segment that will conclude today's broadcast of Deconstructing Dinner, we'll leave you with one last recording from the Q&A following Palagumi's talk. And again, if you missed any of today's broadcast, it will be archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. Unheard segments from Palagumi's talk will also be posted there.
The last famine we had, mass famine, was 1942-43 Bengal famine. Once the British left, we never had that because of the, these were the result of human policy. So what happens? 1860s, we suddenly start growing much more cotton than we need. We grow this cotton, but what happens? The Civil War gets over. The Civil War gets over. Cotton growers in India are getting some good remuneration, and then America re-enters the cotton market, and cotton prices in India and Egypt tank. Right? That was the first globalization. We had a wave of suicides of cotton farmers. Even then, it's the same script being played all over again. People being made to grow what they don't need, people being denied the right to grow what they do need, and made to operate against their interests. The solutions, as you know, I think some of the solutions are pretty obvious. Dismantle neoliberalism. Okay? Don't accept it. I mean, one of the first things is to resist what is being imposed on you. A bunch of mafiosi destroy the planet with their financial products, and then we give them trillions of dollars to set it right. I think that the answer is going to come from you and me. It's going to come from everyday people. It's going to come from ordinary people who have always, in my opinion, been the motor of change. I believe, you know, it's never been easy. It has been done. It won't be easy. It will be done because you are having protests in that unraveling all over. One of the most interesting things I saw in the United States while I was teaching in Berkeley last semester was a strike in the Republic Windows and Doors Company in Chicago, where the owners tried overnight stealing out of the company, locking out and abandoning their workers, who then occupied the factory and demanded their severance pay and their vacation pay and got it. Had that happened before the meltdown, you'd have had the troops or the police in there clubbing those workers and throwing them out as trespassers. Instead, you had Obama declaring support for the striking workers and every celebrity from mayor to governor showing up to declare support. But more importantly, you had ordinary citizens of Chicago going there with food hampers for the strikers. Okay? There's hope.
And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio program is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.